Hello, good morning. You're very welcome to the programme. Between now and nine, a solution to pollution from Carlow, a wry experience in Louth, a party for the humble berry of the hedge, Ar Inis Mann, and apples from the orchards of Roscommon, Clare and Cork. Hello, a very good morning to you. I want to begin this morning with the report by several government agencies on the River Blackwater fish kill. It was published during the week and it was inconclusive. Not enough evidence to say who or what was to blame for the largest fish kill in Irish history. I've talked to a lot of scientists in the river ecology world since that kill in early August. And I think it's fair to say that there is a consensus among them that the investigation into the next kill and the one after that and the one after that will also be inconclusive if things are left as they are. So what has to change about what is getting into our rivers, how they are monitored, how polluters should be dealt with, and how the responsible agencies are resourced? I spent some time in a riverbank this week with Alan Sullivan. Over a long career as a consultant ecologist, he has investigated fish kills in a number of jurisdictions and has a pretty good idea about what best practice is.
Yeah, we were part of a sort of a rapid response team in Devon and Cornwall, Somerset, but mostly Devon. Okay.
So you've seen best of practice, worst of practice?
Absolutely. I mean, it was the National Rivers Authority.
Alan was getting changed into wet gear on the side of a road in Wicklow when I met him.
We did Ballon Glen up here. This is one of the last pieces.
His job that day was surveying a weir with a view to installing a fish pass for migrating salmon.
We have to ask ourselves why we've arrived here. This is not something that arrived here in the last number of years. This has been 50, 60, 70 years in the making.
With decades of experience under his belt, Alan argues it is vital not just to look at the pollution being put into a river, but what we have done to change the shape, the size and the speed of that river too.
It really started off with the Arterial Drainage Act. The morphology of the river as we've done through drainage, they become linear, they become almost flat. If I take the River Nore, in the 1970s, 25 mils of rain, 1 inch of rain, it would have taken the river 3 to 4 days to rise, 3 to 4 days to come down. So you had this constant, steady flow because of all the sponges, the bogs, the wetlands, the manner in which water was attenuated naturally and slowly came back into the river. It kept the river's height up. The solution to pollution, as we keep saying, is dilution. So when you have a river flowing at those kind of rates, the inputs that come into it are much more tolerable by the ecosystem. Okay. Now what we have is everywhere has been drained. The water hits the ground. It runs off really fast. The river gets a massive flood, a big spike, and then it's straight back down to nearly what we would call drought conditions.
So where there used to be a slow rise and fall of the volume of water in rivers, there is now a very rapid, quick rise, a torrent, and then back to near drought conditions.
Correct.
And if the solution to pollution is dilution, well, those are not rivers that have enough water in them to do that job of dilution.
Correct. And everything is acute.
So are we asking rivers to do a job that they could have done in the 40s, 50s and 60s, but in the modern context, they're no longer able to perform?
Correct.
To what extent is there an additional stressor in temperatures? We've just had the warmest summer on record and particularly warm nights.
Well, there's a correlation between the temperature of the water and the amount of oxygen that the water can hold. As the temperature goes up, the amount of oxygen the water can hold goes down. Fish are now living in an environment where it's chronic stress all the time, month after month after month. And we say this is the hottest year. Next year will be the hottest year. And the year after that will be the hottest year. This is not going backwards. So the stressors that I'm talking about are everywhere. We are seeing them everywhere. We're seeing them in Donegal. We're seeing them in Mayo. We're seeing them in Cork, here, Dublin. every river we are in.
So are you telling me that these rivers are now operating in the normal course of events at or just below a threshold in which life is possible, but add in a pollution event and you tip over?
I couldn't have said it better. In its most simple form, that is where we're at, and we are seeing it everywhere. Everywhere we go, we are watching freshwater ecosystems literally clinging on. Literally.
So are you telling me that events like what happened in the Blackwater is something that we can expect to see much more frequently?
Without a doubt. We know this is coming, so we need to be prepared. We would like to see a dedicated rapid response team. We would like to see these incidents treated as if they were a murder scene. We would like to know that there's a 24-hour call line that will respond, because these things don't happen from 9 to 5, they happen all the time.
When the Blackwater fish kill happened, the pollution may have entered the water as much as 3 days before anybody spotted dead fish. To have the best chance at identifying what chemical killed a fish and where it came from, the fish need to be examined as they are dying, not once they're dead. For that, we need technology in our rivers providing information on pollution in real time.
So down here, this is where your kind of detection happens, and that'll separate both nitrate and nitrite.
Nitrite is dissolved ammonia, isn't it?
It kind of is. When you look at the...
There is an Irish company based in Carlow selling exactly that technology all around Europe right now. But bizarrely, there is little or no demand for their tech in Ireland.
If you get either ammonia or nitrite, you're probably going to suffer a mortality event with fish.
There's nothing prototype about this. You're not in beta mode here at all. This is operational and ready to go now this morning, standing here on the side of this river.
100%. They're across Scandinavia in aquaculture farms where people are really looking at water quality as it relates to fish.
And have you happy customers?
Absolutely, yeah. So we recently got a...
Colm Lynch, the CEO of Aqua Monitrix, showed me their kit.
Kingfish King in New Zealand as a thank you for how good our analyzer is.
And how often will it send you data points?
We can run a sample every 15 minutes. It takes 15 minutes to complete a full cycle.
Okay. So in the case of the River Blackwater fish kill, you would have been in a position to say after 15 minutes, hang on, we've detected something untoward in the water.
Yeah, the analyzer will pick it up. It'll give you an early warning system. You can set limits in here so you can get an SMS to your phone or to your email to say, we've got a spike in something. So take an action.
Could a piece of technology like this be used as part of a traffic light system or a stop-go system?
Yeah, so let's say I agreed with you a milligram per litre concentration of nitrate or nitrite, and you said, at that level, I want to make sure there's nothing, no nitrogen load added to the river. So we hit that mark and you get an SMS to say, stop discharging.
If I was a polluter, I was discharging to a river and I wanted you to monitor it for me, and I was to ask you for a monitor upstream and a monitor downstream and then a monitor at the point that I'm discharging, and I want you to maintain them and I want you to send the data to both me and the EPA, give me a bill for that for the year.
Ballpark, you're probably talking at maybe about 4,000 to 5,000 euros per analyzer, so you're looking at costs between 12,000 and 15,000 euros.
And is there an economy of scale? The more monitors that I have, the less that you would charge me, or do you have to charge me $5,000 a monitor?
Everything's an economy of scale. The more we sell, absolutely the better we can do.
Either way, this is something that is in the tens of thousands a year, not the hundreds of thousands
absolutely
for a company.
Absolutely not, no.
Colm Lynch from Aqua Monitrix. I'm joined in studio by two people who probably know more than any other on the island about what needs to be done to restore river health. Professor Mary Burke from Trinity College Geography Department, and also on the line by Professor Fiona Regan, Director of the Water Institute in DCU. Mary's area of expertise is slowing the flow of rivers, and Fiona's is pollution. Two issues that just keep on coming up again and again. Good morning to both of you. Can I start, please, with the same question for both of you? Fiona, you first, because there might be people out there scratching their heads wondering, what does all of this matter? What does it matter, Fiona, if a river dies beyond a few anglers not being able to catch their brown trout?
Good morning, and what a great start, I suppose, for people to understand or to hear what I think maybe is it means if a river dies. A river is really the lifeblood. It's the life support system of our ecosystem. You know, it's lovely to walk by. It's good for well-being, of course, and for anglers, as you say, but it is the lifeblood of the ecosystem. If a river dies, everything collapses. Rivers are habitat corridors. You know, they're like green, blue highways for connecting between forests and grasslands and wetlands for migrating bees and birds and butterflies and so on. They're really, really important in terms of maintaining biodiversity. But of course, we know as well in Ireland, rivers are a source of our drinking water. So it's really important for a whole range of different reasons to maintain them.
All life flows from the water, Mary.
All life flows from the water, and it's really important to understand everything is connected along rivers as well, people and habitats, right from the very source of the river right down to the ocean. So what happens anywhere along a river will affect everywhere else along that river.
Fiona, have you any thoughts on whether a tech-led traffic light stop-go system like the one that we just heard Colm Lynch demonstrating there would work for discharging waste to rivers or not?
Yeah, absolutely it would. It happens already in industries that they have these this technology to alert if something goes wrong. This is not new, but we don't do it typically for discharges from companies or from businesses into waterways. You know, it certainly would give that green light scenario, that traffic light scenario that you mentioned, and anything that we can do to improve what's happening at this point would be really important to implement. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think what's missing at the moment is the idea that climate change changes how we view, you know, our river flows. This was a lovely to listen to at the start of the program, actually, to know that these flows are being impacted by climate change. And so we need to monitor, because the discharges that are licensed currently may not be those levels that can be discharged under this changing climate.
Mary, this is your area of expertise now. Our rainfall patterns are changing, so the flows in our rivers are changing, and the heat in our rivers is changing.
Absolutely. So our winter flows are increasing, our chances of floods are increasing, our summer flows are decreasing, and our chances of droughts are also increasing with that. So Fiona's absolutely right in terms of overall, the extremes are becoming more impactful on our regime.
Okay, so meaning from May to September, no matter how well regulated and monitored a river is, there could be short periods in which the flow goes very, very low.
Absolutely, yes.
Okay. When you read, Fiona, this 100-page report that was just published on Thursday night, there's a timeline that emerges from it that is worth noting. Just bear with me while I go through it, please. This pollutant enters the water possibly on the 5th, maybe on the 6th of August, and it's not noticed by a member of the public until the 9th of August. Inland Fisheries, the responsible agency, finds out on the 11th of August. That's like 6 days after the pollutant has gone in, and they contact the Marine Institute straight away to conduct sampling. 3 days later, the Marine Institute takes its first samples on the 14th of August. A week after that, on the 21st of August, those results are found to be inconclusive, and they realise that they're going to have to go and get an external laboratory who are able to conduct a greater range of tests. But it's not until 8 days after that, on the 29th of August, that samples are delivered to this private lab. So 24 days elapsed between the pollutant entering the river and a lab that had the capacity to run the full range of tests actually receiving samples to run those tests. So my question is, Professor Regan, in your opinion, are these agencies properly resourced to do their jobs?
Well, even listening there to the list of agencies and in relation to those dates is really interesting. This is an area that we term a special area of conservation or special protection area. And for that reason, it needs to be protected. But if you have so many agencies involved, it's very difficult to coordinate. And the earlier, again, the piece that you played, the gentleman referred to the need for a rapid response team. And so the delays that you describe are really worrying. But I think part of that is, it's not that any one agency isn't doing their job. I think the report is quite thorough. It is inconclusive, but I've read each of the results and, you know, they've done what they should do. It's the time that's the challenge. And, you know, in my view, this was like a heart attack on that river. And as that gentleman said, we need a rapid response. We need people out there within a matter of hours, and the technology would help alert us. But we need coordination. I mean, so many in a special area of conservation, we have lots of them around Ireland. We need coordination. And this can happen again if we don't have that rapid response, you know, that ambulance service to be able to respond immediately when something like this happens. So, yeah, I mean, it's shockingly long. But I think in terms of the resources, I think it's more than resources. I think it's actually coordination is the challenge.
Mary Burke, are these agencies properly resourced in your view?
No. And I'd also like to say that the way our rivers are managed in Ireland differs from other jurisdictions in Europe. If you look at the UK, you've got one agency that minds both the hydrological regime, and what I mean by that is the floods and the droughts, and another one, and it also manages the water quality issues. In Ireland, we've got two separate agencies managing both of those problems. We need to have this integrated catchment management where rivers are taken as a unit and there's one head organisation responsible for managing all of the interconnected aspects of that, which all influence each other.
Fiona, I got a technical briefing from three officials at the EPA yesterday on their element of this report, and they showed me the data, which showed that at the time of the fish kill, nobody was breaking the rules. Everybody was in compliance, and I accept completely the accuracy of the EPA's analysis on that. But if everybody is compliant with the rules and 32,000 fish are still killed, is there a problem with the rules?
Well, in relation to the rules on I suppose, license and monitoring and regulation, there is a problem in terms of how we respond in, you know, dealing with people who are polluting. So in that case, yes, because the fines are so small and so really there's no, I suppose, reason for those potential polluters to stop doing that. You know, the rules are there. They do set discharge licenses. But if you look at the flows that are reported in this report, we have seen very low flows.
When you say flows,
you
mean the volume of water in the river at that time?
Yes, exactly. They have reported that volume and how that has changed over the course of July and August. And the response in the report says that the low flow really does not reduce the capacity of rivers to deal with the licensed discharges. But we don't know if this was a licensed discharge. You know, we assume this was a pollution incident. And because of the drought at that time, you know, we are seeing the rivers not being able to respond in the normal ways. So in that sense, yes, perhaps those laws are not meeting the requirements of, you know, the changing climate that is changing everything, really.
Mary Burke, this raises the possibility that there was one of two things at work here. Either a complete cowboy dumped a huge amount of a pollutant into the river, which killed more fish than has ever happened at any point in Irish history, but no trace can be found by any of the scientists of what it was that was dumped. Or it means, as Fiona is suggesting, that in the context of changed weather, changed rainfall, hotter nights, that the rules are no longer fit for purpose in 2025.
I would agree with both of those. And I think that they're going to continue to happen. We're going to have the cowboys and we're going to have the discharges into rivers that can't cope with that discharge. So what we need is a more agile system. So you've already spoken about how the agencies need to be funded better, maybe to have more of a rapid response to getting out to address these. We have the technology now. This is fantastic. And we need to invest in this. We need to enable local communities to be able to run these and report them in. This 24-hour hotline is absolutely fantastic. But our change in climate is rapid. And also within that, the changes of the weather are rapid as well. So we need to have a more dynamic and agile system of people who respond, but also of knowledge to respond to.
And physical changes to our rivers as well. I mean, to reduce the temperature, should we be planting trees, the trees that we removed from all of those riverbanks?
Yes. So one of the main effective ways in which the fish population can survive better and cope better with these increasing temperatures is a bit of shade. And it's not complicated. Mm. And we're not talking about riparian forests everywhere. We're just talking about pools and shade.
Final point to you, Fiona Regan. If we are talking tens of thousands rather than hundreds of thousands to put in static point monitoring like column lynches, do you think that it is reasonable to ask those people who are discharging wastewater to the rivers to pay that bill?
Absolutely. I mean, if part of a license should be that you're monitoring and you're reporting breaches to that license. Absolutely. And, you know, many businesses have these technologies to make sure that they're not polluting, because it means that it damages their business.
Many, but not all.
So many, but not all. Absolutely. And, you know, This is the onus of this is on the business. You know, if they're allowed to discharge into these really valuable resources, these beautiful, you know, lifelines within our country, they have to respect that. And it needs to be within those licenses that they use technologies.
Professor Fiona Regan from DCU's Water Institute and Professor Mary Burke from Trinity College's Geography Department, thank you both very much for joining us this morning. We're harvesting autumn after the break.
Email countrywide at rte.ie. Countrywide on RTE Radio 1.
It's just coming up to 25 to 9, and between now and the end of the programme, we're going to be gathering in the harvest. Berries from the hedgerows, fruit from the orchards, but first, let's hear about this year's rye harvest. Rye is in the same family as wheat and historically was used in distilling and thatching. Nowadays, though, most farmers are planting rye for animal feed. Newer varieties, though, have made the crop more disease-tolerant, and it has comparable yields to the fields of barley that you see everywhere. And with the rise in craft bakeries, rye is also now going into baked goods. Suzanne Campbell visits a farmer and food seller benefiting from this very old but increasingly trendy grain.
I'm eating crackers at McNally's Farm Shop in North Dublin. These aren't ordinary crackers, but made with rye, a crop on the rise in Ireland, with 1,000 hectares more of rye planted this year compared to 2024. While most rye goes into animal feed, demand from us humans is on the rise, especially as sourdough breads and craft bakeries turn to rye for its fermentation properties and taste. So the flour comes down from the mill just above us here.
It comes down in these large half-ton bags, and then they get brought in here once they're cooled, and then we pack out of the bags.
50 kilometres northeast from McNally's farm shop is the source of their rye flour, Dunaney Farm and Mill, where their 2025 rye crop is being cleaned and milled. Farmers Andrew and Leonie Workman take me through to their packing room, where the milled flour arrives before going out to customers. So here's a massive bag, and this is the rye. So it has that richer, darker colour, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's actually a lovely colour. It's a sort of a greeny grey colour.
Yes.
It's quite a long grain and makes a great flour. I would say for the rye, it's probably our second best seller after the wheat. It depends. Its flour can be quite trendy. For a while, spelt was very trendy because it's very low in gluten and easier to digest. Rye is very low in gluten as well, but it would make a much denser loaf. So it's up to the bakers how they want to use it, and they all have their own different recipes. At the moment, it's very popular.
And rye is used very typically in northern European breads, and that was denser, darker bread.
Yes, and the reason why, it's easy to grow on wet ground. Also, it's wet ground, poor soil, doesn't need much fertiliser. If you look after it carefully, you will still get a great crop.
That's positive news to anyone listening to this who farms, because absolutely, we're typically taught, you know, to be a cereal farmer, you need that lovely, well-drained land.
Yep, not particularly in rye. No, okay, absolutely not. It's a very easy crop to grow.
This farm bordering the Louth coast has been in the same family for five generations, with Andrew and Leonie taking over in the 1980s and converting it to tillage and then to organic.
Well, in 1981, we basically came back here and we gradually converted the whole farm from grass to tillage. The price of grain started off being quite good and then gradually tailed off to being the same or less every year. And we were getting less and less for our grain, basically. And the cost of the sprays and the fertilisers were just increasing. And so we had to reconsider ourselves, and took quite a while to reconsider ourselves. And we turned organic. We started in 2004, and in 2 years then we came fully organic in 2006. Then we started saying, right, well, we'll go organic, we'll have organic tillage, and we will sell all our cereals into the compound trade for animal feed. The only issue was that most of the organic farms were in West Cork or the west of Ireland, and it was quite difficult then to get our grain over to them in any kind of bulk loads. And eventually we were saying, this is not working very well for us. And we went into partnership with a mill in Dunlea. We brought our grain to him, he milled it, and then we sold it. But eventually went our own ways, and we carried on from there.
So, Leonie, it was during the pandemic then that demand for flour really took off, and that's had a huge impact on you, hasn't it?
Oh, massively, yes. It just took off because flour wasn't readily available. We sold huge quantities of flour during the pandemic. In that first year, I would say we quadrupled what we were milling and packing.
So, and what was that like, that really phenomenally busy period?
It was a bit mad. We were working in shifts. We brought the family in. Everybody was labelling, packing, stacking, getting the pallets ready, working night and day. That went on for quite a considerable length of time. We were exhausted by the end of it. But it did transform our flour business. It really has grown a lot since then, although demand has dropped, obviously, since the pandemic. But we're still milling and packing a lot now.
Back at McNally's farm shop, the car park is full. People are milling around the cafe getting lunch, and the shop is overflowing with seasonal veg, from potatoes to the more exotic chilies and tomatillos, all grown here in Balbriggan.
It's all grown here, yes, and like we would have started in producers' markets over 25 years ago, and a lot of what we grow now is a result of customers talking directly to Jenny, to my mum, or to the guys at the market, either requesting products or telling them about different veg they miss from home, and they always make it a challenge to try and grow something new every year. So after 25 years, we've ended up with quite the range.
A good shopping experience for people as well, because you've got fridge goods, you've got Goatsbridge trout, you have meats, you have a lot of condiments, olives. I mean, you could create a lot of really good meals from here. I'm just thinking already, like, your stuff is amazing. But what we're here to talk about are these guys here, the sourdoughs and the sourdough rye crackers.
Yes, yes. So we've been working with Leonie and Andrew now for about 5 years. Originally, we came to them because we were stocking their flour in our farm shop about 5 years ago before we opened the bakery. And flour flew off the shelf, particularly it was during COVID time as well. So, of course, everyone was baking their flour at home. But everyone did come back and say, this flour is above and beyond. It's nothing like they've ever had from the standard flour they'd use at home. And it's something then that we carried through when we opened the bakery, the flavour and the quality.
Okay, so let's taste some of Leonie and Andrew's rye. So you used most of the rye percentage-wise in the crackers. They're like a cracker you'd use with cheese. Would that be typical or a condiment?
Yes, yeah. So again, Rory now, he's always experimenting. Him and Sarah, who's in the head chef in the cafe, they're always coming up with new things, and sometimes they'll hit on something and it's the right thing that all of us are like, that's fantastic, let's start developing that. And the crackers really hit that spot because with the rye flour in it, it gives this wonderful, like, nutty, earthy, slightly sweet cracker, but then with the rye, you get that tang and sourdough as well, so you get that tang in true. Perfect cracker, you get that crunch, you get that crisp.
And rye flour, as we know, it's more nutrient dense, so you're getting a lot more bang for your buck with these. They are absolutely gorgeous.
No, they're fantastic.
That actually, nuttiness makes them quite Moorish from the rye, doesn't it?
It really does. And having that, you see that it's just, it's flour, olive oil, salt, water. That's the ingredients. So you really are letting the quality of the ingredients shine through the cracker itself. And you really see the importance of good ingredients. You get good products out of them for sure.
I tasted one of those crackers. I tell you, they're not exaggerating at all. Suzanne Campbell there in McNally's Farm Shop in North County Dublin. Hundreds of farms across the country have taken advantage of support from the Acre scheme to plant 10 native apple trees on their farms. Varieties of apple like Rose Hogan, the Beauty of Ballantaylor, or the Dick Davies. This part of the scheme is still open for a few more weeks, so if you wanted a bit of advice in deciding what variety would best suit your land and part of the country, Irish Seed Savers Association in Scariff in County Clare is running an event showcasing the more than 200 varieties of apples in their care. And joining me in studio to tell us more about these heritage apples is Elaine Bradley, Executive Director of Irish Seed Savers Association. Good morning, Elaine. How are you?
Good morning, Phil.
You've brought plenty of apples in. Well done, you. So let's just get straight to them. The Ardcairn Russet is the first one. Why have you chosen this?
Okay, I suppose one of the things to say for the people listening is if you look at the selection in front of us, they're not beautiful, they're not uniform, they're not like the pink ladies you'll see in the supermarket. And the russet in particular, it's called that because it has a rusty texture on the skin. It's from
which is slightly rougher than the very smooth and polished exteriors that we see in supermarkets.
Absolutely, it's a texture as well as a colour.
Okay, I'm tasting now. That's almost like a pear.
Exactly, exactly. One of the things that people don't realise is there are so many different tastes, textures, colours to the apples. And that's what we're trying to promote through heritage trees,
that
really.
That is very, very novel, entirely new taste to me. I thought that my jaded palate was never going to experience anything new. That is very interesting. Okay, the next one up is the Scarlet Crofton, which almost looks like a plum or plum colour.
Again, that's a russet. It's got a laced effect on the outside. It's called lacing. It's sort of mottled. And the Scarlet Crofton, we can trace it back about 400 years in Ireland. It was from County Sligo, from the Longford estate in County Sligo.
Uh-huh. Much softer in texture. A little bit more tart. But again, my God. It's almost got a bit of sort of flavour of gooseberry in there as well. These are not the tastes that we associate with the four varieties of apple we're able to get in our supermarket.
Absolutely not. We have another one in our collection called Appletown Wonder. It's from Limerick. It was found by students from Drumcollaher College down there. And last year, when we had our tasting tours, the people on the tour decided it tasted like champagne. So we're calling it the champagne apple as well. But there's just such a wide variety of taste and flavour.
And we have all of these varieties thanks to the work of a group of people called palmologists, one of the leading figures of which was Dr. Keith Lamb. Tell me about him.
Yeah, he was a really interesting figure. He was actually from Frascati House in Blackrock, and he studied agricultural science. And for his thesis, he did research into apples in Ireland, and it was a sort of diminishing, they were diminishing because of various projects about replacement and, you know, introducing what was seen as being higher yield apples, and people were grubbing out the old trees. So he set out to find the heritage apples. And his thesis, which was published by the RDS in 1951, is a seminal work. And at the time, he concluded a lot of the trees were lost that he'd found in the literature. But he did assemble a number of the trees, and there was an orchard planted by UCD, which at the time was in Glasnevin, and it was accidentally bulldozed in the 1970s to make way for a car park. Fortunately, we have the collection still. It's at Seed Savers, and some of it is in UCD here in Belfield.
And surprisingly enough, we're still finding new apples, or at least back in the 1990s, you found this one that I have in my hand now, the Ballyvaughan seedling. Tell me about it.
Yeah, well, it's from Ballyvaughan, or as they say in Clare, Ballyvaughan seedling. Mm-hmm. If you think of orchards, you probably think
of... Oh, wow. Oh, that is... Tangy.
It is. It's a dual use. It's mostly a cooker, but you can eat it as well. Some people like the sort of...
Okay, am I eating that at the right time of year? If I had put that into my mouth a month ago, would it be very bitter?
Yes, and if you had it in a few weeks' time, it'd probably be sweeter as well. So you don't really think about apple trees clinging to the western seaboard of Europe, but that's what the Ballyvaughan seedling is or does. And it was found by Anita Hayes. It was brought into our collection in the 1990s by our founder, Anita Hayes.
That's interesting, because you would frequently be told, if you have marginal land, if you have peaty land, if you have exposed land, do not even think about planting apple trees. But presumably this one is well suited to exactly those conditions.
Absolutely. We went to the Cahir Valley to the Cahir Bridge Gardens there. And Carl, who owns the gardens, brought us up to a famine village. We found two very old trees there and we collected samples and we got them DNA tested. And they were also Ballyvaughan seedlings. So we know that they were used in a widespread way in that region at the time, and probably going back to the 1800s.
Tell me, well, now that you mentioned the 1800s, the story behind the Sweet William.
Yeah, so that was one of the trees that Dr. Lamb thought was lost, couldn't be found, and it turned up in the United States. We know this again by a combination of characterization and genetic testing. And it was brought back to Ireland by Dr. Gordon Reid, and it's now in our collection. Okay.
And it may have gotten there via the coffin ships.
Exactly. That when people used to emigrate, before the famine even, what they do is they would bring with them what's called scion, S-C-I-O-N, a piece of wood. They put in a potato to keep it fresh and hydrated.
So a little cutting.
Cutting.
A twig.
Yeah.
Just plunked into a potato and it survived the voyage.
Yeah. And it's from a particular family of apple tree called self-rooters. So they don't grow on other roots. You don't need to graft them onto other rootstock. You can plonk them in the ground and they'll sprout their own roots.
All right. So when they got to the New World, they didn't have to be grafted onto another tree. They could be put into the ground. So what has come back from the United States to us is genetically true.
That's exactly right. As far as we know, it's the Sweet William that originated in Ireland, and it's back here again.
I looked, in fact, I have it here in front of me, the list of the 200 different varieties, the heritage varieties that we have in this country. Is this a way of future-proofing ourselves rather than just relying on a very small number of varieties growing as many as possible?
Absolutely. I mean, most people know now that diversity and biodiversity is a good thing. It's about hedging your bets and spreading the risk, really. The narrower the gene pool that we're relying on for our food, the more risk we're at. And what these heritage trees are, is they're repositories, the orchards are repositories of genetic diversity and richness as well. These trees have emerged from our soil, our land, our ecology. They've co-evolved with wildlife and insect life here. So they're really good for the biodiversity as well.
Give me your website address for people to go and look up this event today if they want to go.
It's irishseedsavers.ie.
Thank you very much, Elaine Bradley, for joining us this morning. And I might hold on to those apples. And indeed, let's just stay with apples. This is going to make me sound a hell of a lot more homespun and folksy than I am in reality. But the greatest treat of these weeks every year has to be a handful of cooking apples thrown into a pie or a crumble with blackberries from the hedgerow that are heaving with them right now. Such a good idea that on Inishman Éireann Ilan Aran, they have a whole festival dedicated to the blackberry. Féile na Puachtaí, a celebration of our little native berry. And Trasa Vranach headed to the island for us last week and fell into conversation with Aideen the Tierney.
So, tam wyd eich ffeil yn y bwytioch chi, mae'r sy'n fasio chomadw yn tosw, leis yn y bwytioch chi i ddhein.
Well, blackberries themselves have a lot of good things going for them, but in Inish Meon they have a particular significance because the word here for blackberry isn't smear dove, like what you'd have in the rest of the Gaeltachtaí. Here they say puichochi, and it's a special word in Inish Meon. People listening might be like, but puichoch isn't that mud in Irish, but I suppose it's it's a squishy, squashy thing, you know? And what essentially is a blackberry, but a squishy, squashy thing. So, like, here for us as well, I suppose, the blackberry has become more important because we have Féilín na Buachaillí now. And we use the blackberries in Inis Mion to celebrate everything that's fantastic about the island and its people. And I'm trying to find a few now on the Craig. I think there's a good patch up here. We'll go up there.
Okay, there's a good few blackberries here, or Buachaillí here. What makes a good blackberry?
I suppose it depends on the season. It's the weather really, and I'm sure that makes a good blackberry. But for me, I want to pick one that when you pick it, it shouldn't fall apart in your hand, you know, and you want to pick it and it should still be white in the centre, and you want it to be sweet, but kind of sharp as well. And in Inis Mion, we're very blessed because we have an unusual landscape here. We have a karst landscape, and all of that acts as a storage heater throughout the year, which slowly soaks up the sun, or what little bit of sun we have in the summer, and then releases it. And that gives an extra flavour to the Buachaillí. So whether you're making jam or gin or liqueur or tarts, everything will have a little extra Inis Mion kick, which we love. I'm going to eat this now and see if it's appropriate. Yeah. I like them to be kind of gayer, you know, have a little kick.
Dearmuid O'Mahona from Putla Cafe in Invern. Your cafe is an award-winning, multi-award-winning cafe at this stage, and you're here judging the baking competition as part of Féilín na Buachaillí. Tell me a little bit about baking with blackberries.
The thing that I remember most about baking growing up, they're always lovely in an apple tart. A couple of apple and blackberry tarts are just something you look forward to come the autumn.
And is it too late to make jam?
It's never too late to make jam. No, and I mean, if you do it right, and if the jar is well sterilised and put aside, she'll have it for the rest of the winter, and you'll be tasting that lovely kind of end of summer taste all the way through the winter. That's, I suppose, the beauty of things like jam. The other one, if you really don't want to go cooking it, they do one in the kind of Scandinavian region. It's called shaken berry, where basically you just put the fruit and the sugar in a jar and shake the hell out of it, and it will preserve it for a lot longer than the fruit itself would last. And it's a beautiful way to have it just on top of your porridge.
And would you have any other suggestions? Maybe you often see blackberry and pear jams, you know, what kind of flavours can you match making jam?
Well, I suppose with the blackberries, part of the reason that you end up having other fruit with them is because they've no pectin. So the apple has the pectin to set the jam, like even just a small bit of apple. And they pair well because they're both in season things, usually in season together, pair quite well together. Apples, pears, you could make it and just use jam sugar, which has pectin in it. Blackberries and raspberries. Blackberries and rhubarb are beautiful as well because you have that sharpness from the rhubarb and sweetness from the blackberries. I love it in a tart and things like that. It's amazing.
Now, I'd hold a stop at the Tory Tashke. Ta focal drichta.
Kid ain't kid clue.
English for group after.
Yes.
Cut kinatula. It's going on, sir.
All right. On the kid clue. Gilio gui jessa jessa. Gilio gui jessa boy. Gilio gui jessa jessa. A dancer ed a grief. Car olen dine on dawn shop. Ta on kid clue ele a fanachlet.
So, Damien, you're setting up for the art class here.
Yes, yeah, we're going to do a very art class using materials from the island. So we've made blackberry ink, which I made on Thursday night. And we're going to be using shells and potatoes that we've grown on the island and all local stuff here.
Tell me, how difficult is it to use blackberries to make ink?
It's actually quite straightforward. You know, all I did was put the blackberries, mixed it with bread soda and water, and just boiled it off, and then just strained it. That was pretty much it. Oh, sorry, salt as well, and that actually preserves it. You can use white vinegar. So if you use the baking soda, it turns it slightly green, but if you use white vinegar, it makes it more purple. I wanted that, but I found that I just had malt vinegar, not white vinegar. And of course, I live in Inis Mion, so I can't just go out and buy it. So I had to use baking soda.
Oh, kind of shame. No, Rosha, he talked Rosha.
Is there particular folklore that's connected with the Buachaillí here on the island?
There certainly is so much local folklore or bailadas. So first of all, you have na Dhrisachí, that's your bramble. One of the big stories is that in Míonna Samhna or November, people would go collecting the Dhrisachí, they'd tie a rope to them, and then hop up on top of the roof, and the rope with the drishachy would go down and up, and that's how we traditionally clean the chimney in Inis Mion. So that's one story that people really love. Another is, like, jam making wasn't a big thing here, but they did love to have a dessert of puichachy, which was really simple. It was just like they collect the berries, put a little bit of sugar on top and smush them up with banya. And then in terms of pishoga, and that this is something that you'd hear in a lot of places, people would be worried about the puka on Iche Haun. And the puka was this sort of like mischievous shape shifter, and out and about he would be on Iche Haun. And depending on kin or to will to, the sort of trickery he'd be up to on Iche Haun kind of changes. Some stories say that the puka would spit on the puichachy on Iche Haun, so you should never eat them after that night. But in other places it can get a little bit ruder, and he might urinate or do something even worse. So again, that was the pishogir, the superstition to inform people not to eat the puichachy or go picking them after Iche Haun. But again, entertaining a story as it is, there's a grain of truth in it, because you shouldn't really be eating them after that time, because, you know, flies are laying eggs in them and ní bheadh sé sláinn tú. So you take a bit of fun and then you find the truth in it too. So the hover than chose our gore, we have the puichachy, which is a ripe blackberry when it's nice and black and juicy, but we also have smeary, and the smeary are the red blackberry. So a blackberry before it's ripe, mm-hmm. And people kind of get shocked about that. They think, why are you eating them? You know?
Are you saying you can eat them?
Of course you can. I mean, it's been blather and you're gone, you wouldn't be having a full meal of them. But they were like a sour sweet and the smeary, I guess Hanashi Gomorlesh Nadina, people love them.
There's a good few blackberries here, and I'm going to try one of the smear that you said.
Yeah, go for this one. This is a nice,
juicy one. That's a good one. Okay.
Does she crua?
Okay, no.
Not a fan.
That is not a fan.
See, they're tough in Inis Mion.
Chimney sweeping with brambles. What other programme would offer you these little nuggets? Trasa Vranach reporting there on Inis Mion. That's all that we have time for today. Following a morning's blackberry picking, the countrywide team, Eileen Heron, Amandine Paso Devine, Dave Gibson, all have no berries in the bowl but have suspiciously scarlet lips. Playback is up after the news at 9. Until next week, have fun in the hedgerows.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player.